Hey folks, it's Bob from Retronauts, and I'm here to let you know that Jeremy and I will once again be at the Portland Retro Gaming Expo this year in Portland, Oregon. It's happening this Sunday, October 19th to 21st, and on the 21st, that's a Sunday, at 3:30, we'll be doing a panel on full motion video games. This will be our sixth year in a row at the show, and we really hope to see you there. And if you're a fan of Talking Simpsons, I'll also be doing two live shows with my pal Henry Gilbert in Portland that weekend. On Saturday, October 20th, we'll be doing two live shows at Kelly's Olympian in Portland, Oregon, and that'll be happening at 426 Southwest Washington Street. We'll be covering the greatest hits of the Simpsons Halloween episodes with a 2 o'clock show and a 5 o'clock show, and our 5 o'clock show will have, as a special guest, Bill Oakley, former Simpsons writer and showrunner. Tickets are going fast, so if you want to attend either of the Talking Simpsons live shows, go to tinyurl.com/TalkingSimpsons Halloween. That's tinyurl.com/TalkingSimpsons Halloween. Once again, you can see us Sunday, October 21st at the Portland Retro Gaming Expo at 3:30 p.m. And you can see Talking Simpsons live on Saturday, October 20th at 2 o'clock p.m. and 5 o'clock p.m. And again, go to tinyurl.com/TalkingSimpsons Halloween to get tickets. That's three big live shows, and I can't wait to see you folks there in Portland.
This week in Retronauts, who wants a body massage?
Body massage machine, go.
What? That's not how it goes.
It does.
That, of course, was a reference to the Fensler films. I'm sure you guys have seen those. Chris obviously has.
I've had my share of pork chop sandwiches.
Okay, there we go.
And I used to watch those over
binge,
and over and over.
I'm sure
again.
You have stopped all the downloading.
Yeah.
Yes. Hi, everyone. It's Jeremy Parrish here at Retronauts East. And this week we are talking about G.I. Joe, not just the Fensler films. Actually, probably we're not going to talk about those much at all. But they are, I think, a... kind of like a character witness for the cultural impact and importance of the topic we are discussing, which is G.I. Joe. And this is another one of those episodes that's going to be about games, but also not, because there just aren't that many G.I. Joe video games. And also because all of us here grew up with G.I. Joe, playing with the toys, watching the cartoons, reading the comics, whatever, and have some things to say about the property in general. So, gentlemen, please introduce yourselves.
I am the Silent Master of the Rashikage Ninja Clan, a.k.a. Chris Sims.
And over here in the left corner.
Benj Edwards. I am a guy who loves G.I. Joe.
What is your primary military specialty, Benj?
Oh, gosh. I had a custom G.I. Joe guy made for me when I was a kid. You could send off for,
the Steel Brigade guy.
But you get to write what your thing was. I think mine was like karate specialist
what?
Or something. I don't know.
You should totally be like the replacement for Dial Tone or something. Like the, the technical engineering, you know, Mainframe. They had a computer guy.
Yeah.
They have engineers. Time, they have tinkerers.
At that age, I did not know that I was interested in that kind of stuff. I just wanted to kick some ass.
Oh, okay. I guess my only equivalent on the team would be Scoop, who's terrible. He's the journalist. And
there's Hashtag. She's actually really good.
I don't think that Hashtag. Counts. There's no toy of Hashtag.
There is.
Where?
There's a toy of Hashtag.
Where?
In the 20th anniversary or 30th anniversary.
Are you talking about Agent Helix?
No, I'm not talking about Agent Helix. We can talk about Agent Helix.
Let's not.
And the Wraith.
Let's not.
Who only loves two things.
I do not know Hashtag.
Hashtag was part of the Fred Van Lente run on G.I. Joe from maybe like 10 years ago. She was their social media specialist.
Look, nothing after 1990 counts.
I don't think that's true, not, because then you miss out on the Alley Viper, and you miss out on Big Brawl.
95 is the cutoff.
The Might of Right? Come on. Or the Right of Might? I don't know. Anyway.
And Sergeant Slaughter.
Sergeant Slaughter was 85, 86.
Okay, fine. Yeah, you're right. I had him.
Everyone had him because he was free.
He was awesome.
Because if you owned G.I. Joe toys, he was like $1.80. Oh, you got the with the triple T.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, I remember getting that at Toys R Us. Yeah. I love G.I. Joe toys. I had tons of them. The only one I never got was the hovercraft. And, of course, I didn't have the SS flag.
Yeah, I was about to ask if you had the flag.
Like, no one had that. A friend of my brother's down the street when I was a kid had that, and it took up their whole closet. I know we've talked about this for some reason.
Probably. Yeah. The USS flag was an amazing piece of plastic that could not exist in this day and age.
It is bonkers that it, like, came out and was sold.
Yeah, like, it was definitely for kids who had a basement all to themselves where they could play with their toys, and parents who were, you know, rolling in Ronald Reagan cocaine banking money, which were not my parents. My dad was a teacher, so I was like, wow, I get to buy a $3 figure every 6 months. That's great. I like school lunches. They're free.
Weirdly enough, I was never super into the toys as a kid, but when the 25th anniversary toys came out, I became obsessed with them. So I had at one time like all of the 25th anniversary G.I. Joes, which are really, really good toys because they're, you know, they were made in 2007. So they're like, the sculpts are higher quality. I heard them described as being what you remember the original toys looking like.
Right. Well, except the early line, the early ones did have diaper crotch where like their waist pieces were cut very full in the front, not in like a like, wow, he's packing, but more like a diaper. Wow, he's dressed like Donald Trump playing golf.
He needs a change.
Exactly. they were flattering, but yeah, those, the 25th anniversary line eventually became the 30th anniversary line. And the later figures in that line are like, how are you doing this in 4 inches of plastic? It's so detailed. My favorite, I think, ridiculous element of that entire line was Low Light, the sniper. He comes with a bullet. He comes with a 2-scale bullet that is, you know, proportionate to a 4-inch action figure. Oh, it's so tiny and stupid. And I love that they did that.
Yeah. A tiny bullet. I remember now the last G.I. Joe figure I ever bought was in the Street Fighter 2 series. They had a Blanka.
That would be the end for
Ryu.
Me too, yeah.
What year was that, you think?
That was like 93-ish. Yeah. They also did Mortal Kombat, but yeah.
I didn't have those.
Yeah, so which one you got, Ryu and Blanka?
Yeah, Ryu. I always say Ryu.
That's fine.
Man, I don't know how to pronounce it.
Blanka. So you got the two of them, no bad guys.
I got Chun-Li at home.
Wasn't she based on the Scarlet body? Like, it was like the Ninja Force Scarlet?
I think so, because there was a lot of repurposing.
They also used a bunch of the toys for Jurassic Park and for Mortal Kombat. Like those little 3¾ action figures, they went places.
The cool thing about the 20th anniversary set was that at the time Hasbro had Indiana Jones and Marvel Universe figures that were also like 4-inch scale.
Mm-hmm.
So I had. For a long time, I had like the Punisher driving around in the Awestriker with Indy hanging off the side with his whip.
Right. Wow. Did you have though the pre-Cobra Commander figure that they had? It was a Comic-Con special, and they used like, I think Marcus Brody or someone, or like some dude in a suit, but it's like a guy in a suit wearing the Cobra Commander mask, and he comes with a little podium.
I wanted it so bad. The only San Diego one that I ever got was the movie Destro.
Okay, not the Pimp Daddy Destro.
Not the Pimp Daddy Destro. Although I did have a custom plush doll of Destro with the leopard print collar.
Nice.
But I got the one that has like Christopher Eccleston Destro, mm-hmm. and then also his weird ancestor from the movie.
Oh, right. Yes.
Because I'm a Destro guy.
You are. You're happy Destro.
I am indeed.
I like Destro.
He was an interesting character, and I think he kind of actually gets to what makes G.I. Joe as a property unique, especially the 80s iteration of G.I. Joe. And we should probably talk about that because we've just been like farting around with our memories and everyone in the audience is like, what the hell? What are you guys talking about? So G.I. Joe.
Yo, Joe!
We'll fight for freedom wherever there's trouble. G.I. Joe is there. G.I. Joe.
American hero. G.I. Joe is there.
It's G.I. Joe against Cobra and Destro, fighting to save the day. He never gives up. He's always
the
there.
Name.
Of America's daring, highly... Nah, anyway.
G.I. Joe. I can do that part.
Okay. Go ahead. Give us the lowdown.
Which part do you want me to talk about?
G.I. Joe.
G.I. Joe is like a bunch of pseudo...
No, you're supposed to do the bit. Come on, you just said you could do it.
Oh, Well, okay.
You didn't think I was going to call your bluff, did you?
G.I. Joe is the name of America's highly trained...
Daring,
highly trained special mission force. Their mission,
purpose.
Their purpose.
Is to defend human freedom.
To defend human freedom.
Okay, against Cobra.
Against Cobra.
Come on, this is like the Boy Scout oath here. Yeah. You should know it.
It's
this
been a
childhood.
Long time since I've seen the cartoon.
All right.
You know, well, a me ruthless too, but... terrorist organization bent on... That wants to rule the world.
Something
sorry,
like
I should have memorized it before it came over. But
yeah, I didn't tell you guys there would be a quote.
I could sing the song, okay. Including the Cobra verse, if you want.
Yo, Joe!
Oh, you're doing the movie song.
Yeah, the extended version. With the best animation that G.I. Joe ever had for 5 minutes.
Yeah, it was pretty great.
Yeah.
So anyway, yes, G.I. Joe... Okay, to start with, I actually gave a really great breakdown of the complete history of G.I. Joe on the What a Cartoon podcast that Retronauts co-host Bob Mackey runs with Henry Gilbert. So look that up. That was in September of 2018. It's the episode, looked at the cartoon episode, There's No Place Like Springfield. Wow, I somehow can't talk. That episode has the total breakdown of the G.I. Joe property, starting with the G.I. Joe toy line of the 60s and all the way up to the cartoon in the 80s.
Yeah, but we're specifically talking about G.I. Joe : A Real American Hero.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, it is worth saying that G.I. Joe started as a Barbie-scale toy, a doll for boys, but boys won't buy dolls because toys have to be gendered. So they were action figures. And instead of having, you know, like a refrigerator, they had Kung Fu Action Grip. So they were very detailed, well-articulated, very accurate toys based on, you know, military concepts. And the guy was just like G.I. Joe. Every character was G.I. Joe. That was just what he was called. And then Vietnam happened and people stopped liking the military so much in America. So G.I. Joe became the adventure team and started chasing Bigfoot in the Arctic and doing some weird stuff. And then the OPEC oil crisis happened and toys became very expensive to make because they were made of plastic, which uses oil. And so G.I. Joe went away pretty much.
Bigfoot went extinct too.
Well, that's because of G.I. Joe.
Yeah.
I mean,
Bigfoot hunting was up 300% after that line.
Meanwhile, at Marvel Comics, Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., was a well-regarded property, having been revitalized by Jim Steranko in the 60s, and become a sort of ersatz James Bond super spy property that was rooted in a military comic from the 50s and 60s called Sergeant Fury and His Howling Commandos. So a young up and comer named Larry Hama pitched a new version of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. / Howling Commandos that was going to be called Fury Force. That would be about Nick Fury's son leading a new
team. James Bond Jr. of Marvel.
Yeah. Except for James Bond Jr. was actually James Bond's nephew, which figure that one out. That's for a different time.
Yeah.
So the idea was that this would be this new generation of Howling Commandos, but they would be going on what were essentially like James Bondy type missions, which if you've seen the James Bond movies of the 70s and 80s is a lot of world traveling and dealing with like the
science fiction stuff.
Yeah. Sci-fi stuff and like criminal cartels. So that didn't happen.
It did not.
Instead, Hasbro came to Marvel wanting to do a tie-in comic.
Right. So yeah, the important thing to remember is that in 1977, this little thing called Star Wars came along, and Kenner bought the rights to Star Wars to make toys, thinking, this will, you know, like there's some Star Trek toys out there and other stuff like that. So this might be worth something. So they jumped in and didn't actually have toys ready for the movie's launch. The toys didn't come out until like 78. But people really loved Star Wars. It turned out to be successful. And Kenner suddenly was like, wait a minute, we can make a lot of money. So they put out the placeholder box at retail. Like you go to Sears, buy a box, an empty box for Christmas. It was like, if you bought this box, then you're going to get 8 action figures next year. And that was a huge runaway hit. And all of a sudden, like the toy line became in a lot of ways more valuable as a property than Star Wars, the movie. And everyone who made toys was like, wait a minute. And I think Hasbro especially, you know, having had this history of G.I. Joe and boys' toys, were like, these tiny action figures would be much less expensive and much oil friendlier than the big action figures we've been making. So they decided to jump in on that. They looked to Japan, where their sort of collaborator Takara was making a series called Microman, which was originally also like a 12-inch figure that they shrank down to a 3-inch line or 3 3/4-inch line with very, very detailed bodies. Like they were kind of equivalent to the 12-inch articulation that G.I. Joe had been using. So all these things came together and Hasbro was like, yeah, let's make G.I. Joe the toy at this new scale. And they said, you know, Star Wars was popular not because the toys were cool, because they were cool, but that wasn't what drove the toy sales. It was because there was this movie attached to it. And kids want something to kind of spark their imagination, like a starting point, a property to work from. So they decided to build a property around their toy line. And that's where they went to Marvel.
Yeah, there was the idea that you had to teach kids how to play with the toys. This is the same idea that would come back in Secret Wars, where Mattel, which was left out of the Hasbro Kenner explosion, had been trying to get a foothold with Masters of the Universe, which was a success in terms of having a toy line. But when they wanted to get a license, they got the Marvel superheroes. So Secret Wars was, according to Jim Shooter, to teach kids how to play with the toys.
Yeah, and I'm assuming that Hasbro went to Marvel specifically because Marvel had the Star Wars comics. So they were like, you guys know how to do this, you know, tie-in property thing pretty well.
Marvel at the time had a really strong record of doing tie-in comics.
Right, and that was like the only thing that was saving their butts at the time.
Star Wars saved Marvel in the 70s and was a huge hit. But also, they had done ROM Space Knight starting in 78, which was an action figure, quote-unquote, line that had one toy. It was ROM the Space Knight. And there was no mythology behind the toy. There was just this weird robot from space that came with some light-up accessories. Marvel created a series. Bill Mantlow wrote it for 80 issues. There's an 80-issue ROM series.
Yeah.
And the funniest thing about it is that it is in the Marvel universe. He hangs out with Rick Jones, which is the most Marvel thing you can do.
Well, Tech Transformers were in the Marvel universe at first.
So was G.I. Joe.
Oh, was he?
G.I. Joe was briefly. So was Godzilla, actually. The 70s Godzilla series, Godzilla gets yelled at by J. Jonah Jameson and is hunted down by
a Where is G.I. Joe in the Marvel Universe? There is a part where they parachute into the Bayonne Mall, and they land on a guy who's dressed as the Hulk, but he's just like a character, you know, performer.
There are references to Marvel Universe stuff that quickly go away.
Huh.
And then because Transformers also exists in G.I. Joe, because they team up with Tank Megatron 10 years down the line, then there's a transitive property.
Oh, God.
Nothing yeah, I forgot about the Dr. Biggles-Jones plot arc.
Oh, Dr. Biggles-Jones made me cry when she finally got it. Nothing was as in the Marvel Universe as ROM and Godzilla.
Mm.
Godzilla was full on. Like Godzilla,
and Dracula.
Dracula's not licensed, though. Dracula's public domain.
I'd like to say
Castlevania
that,
disagrees.
Yeah, ROM, I had issues of ROM when as a kid. I was like, this is the most lame thing I've ever seen. I had no idea it was a toy, but that makes sense now.
And I mean, they would do other toy tie-in stuff, like US-1 was based on a remote control truck, and there was Team America that was based on like remote control motorcycles, and everything had to be like weirdly retrofitted once the license went away. Like the monster that was Godzilla still exists in the Marvel Universe under a different name. It mutated into a similar to, but legally distinct from.
Right, kind of like the equivalent of Shuma-Gorath or something.
Right. And ROM, you know, for a while, like, the funny thing is, Marvel created all the stuff around ROM. So, like, all the Space Knights could exist in the Marvel Universe even after they lost the license. The planet Galador, like, all of that stuff. But ROM himself,
like,
you could...
Oh, no, that's Gallifrey, never mind. Yeah. I was like, wait a minute,
Galador,
what?
Galador, completely
different. Okay, Galador, totally different, totally different.
Point being, like, by 1980, Marvel had... Two, regardless of Benj's feelings, ROM was a hit. Like ROM ran for a really long time.
So ROM, no Iron Man in your esteem?
Yeah, I didn't get the appeal of it.
Sorry. It's a series that I think is worth revisiting, but unfortunately you can't because it's never going to be reprinted because now a different company has the license.
I have all the copies of it.
Because Benj took them all.
Yeah, I took them all. I'm burning them right now.
But
so yes, back to G.I. Joe.
Yeah.
Marvel, now back to G.I. Joe.
Marvel was the place where licensed comics went. DC didn't really have a lot of licenses. They had done like Masters of the Universe mini comics, and we've talked about the Sword Quest mini comics that were published through DC. But when you've got Superman and Batman, you don't need licenses. Marvel had Conan, which was a huge hit, that again would run for 110 issues. So all of these licensed properties that had all of this cross-genre appeal, that had ties to movies like Conan and Star Wars and had ties to toys, those were all coming from Marvel.
And so and we so. Have the collaboration between Marvel and Hasbro, which it was pretty revolutionary. It kind of set the tone and the stage for the approach to toys that we'd see throughout the 80s with stuff like He-Man and Transformers and I don't know. What the hell else?
Strawberry Shortcake.
My Little Pony, I don't know. Yeah, sure. All that stuff. Like, G.I. Joe kind of set the tone for it. And basically, they came to Hasbro, or Hasbro came to Marvel and were like, help us come up with a fiction for these characters. And initially, it was just going to be G.I. Joe. And Marvel, having experience with comics and narrative and storytelling and all of that, said, well, there's got to be conflict, so you're going to need some bad guys. And so you end up with Cobra. Totally not Hydra. Absolutely in no way at all like Hydra. Totally different.
Definitely not Hydra.
Yeah. And so, yeah, basically, like, Larry Hama was given this assignment. And it was kind of one of those things. It was, you know, everyone was like, I'm going to pass this buck. No thanks. A toy comic? Nah, I don't want to do that. I mean, there was licensed toys or comics were good business for Marvel, but it wasn't the business anyone there wanted to do. I mean, Star Wars, like, you know, you had... you know, those early comics by Chaykin, but they quickly were kind of passed down to the sort of like the B team.
Yeah.
And people, you know, they wanted to do their Spider-Man stories and their X-Men stories. Well, no, okay, that was Claremont only. Bad example, Iron Man stories or, you know, Punisher or whatever.
But yeah, I mean, if nothing else, doing a licensed property, as someone who has done a handful of licensed comics, I've never had a bad experience, but there is an additional layer of approval. You know, like, something not only has to get past the editor, they have to send it in to the licensor.
Well, I think it was also just a matter of prestige. Like, Do you want to come up with a character who could be as heavy hitter, as much of a heavy hitter as Spider-Man? Do you want to be the one who creates Venom? Or do you want to work on a toy property that's probably going to go away in a year?
Yeah. 12 issues. You know, was probably what they were expecting, because that's what...
Well, and the interesting thing is, if you look at the early G.I. Joe comics, the first 12 issues or so are kind of like these little self-contained stories. And then after that, I guess once they started to get some traction, Larry Hama started building out this huge, elaborate mythos for the series. And basically issues, I would say like 12 or 13 through somewhere in the 50s, is just like this huge, sprawling, epic arc of... It's about toy characters, but like it feels pretty convincing. There's some goofy stuff in there sometimes. You know, he definitely had to accommodate for characters like Zartan, but he made the best of it. And he could do that because Hasbro was like, define these characters for us. And so Larry Hama wrote all the file cards for almost every single G.I. Joe character through the original run of the series. I think Stephen King wrote a file card and... But aside from that, like, yeah, well, his son Owen King was a huge G.I. Joe fan. So he actually, there is a character, I think Sneak Peek, his file name is Owen King, if I'm not mistaken.
Wow.
So it's like a reference to Stephen King's son. But then I think Stephen King wrote the file card for Crystal Ball, who never really got, like, anytime Larry Hama didn't define a character himself, that character had very little part in the comic book. Like, I talked about this on the What a Cartoon podcast. Shipwreck was originally created for the cartoon, so he had almost no role in the comic. Quick Kick, we're going to talk about him later with Action Force. He was created for the cartoon originally also, so he shows up in like one issue, and then 30 issues later, he's one of the people just slaughtered in Trucial Abysma when the Saw Viper like kills off all the dud characters that Hama was like, can I kill these guys? And Hasbro said, sure, we're not going to do anything with them.
R.I.P. Dusty. R.I.P. Footloose.
R.I.P. Doc. I took it right in the face.
Doc
right
one.
In the face. Doc one. Yeah.
Doc One. I didn't know those guys were dead. Now I'm sad.
They totally got killed.
Oh man.
Yeah. There was a big house clearing in the early 90s.
Shoot.
Yeah.
Yep.
But don't worry. Snake Eyes got his revenge on the Saw Viper.
He did. And also one of the characters lived.
One of them lived. Yeah.
Oh wait, somebody sneak peek. Away. He didn't actually die.
Yes.
They thought he did, but he didn't. And that's because Larry Hama, writing the comic 20 years later, forgot that he had killed Sneak Peek. And then he was like, oh God, I gotta work that out.
Yeah. That's, which brings me to the big point, which is that it wound up being Larry Hama who had this pitch that he was going to use for Fury Force. That he basically just retrofitted onto G.I. Joe and Cobra. And, you know, Nick Fury Jr. became Hawk. And he wrote that comic. Larry's worked on Wolverine, Batman, plenty of stuff. He's been an editor at Marvel. He's had, like, creator-owned stuff published. Right.
Before that, though, he was, like, an indie comic guy.
Yeah,
he was his stuff in the 70s is, like, super kind of underground.
Yeah. He was one of the Krusty Bunkers in the weird, like, inking collective in New York. He was also on Saturday Night Live once.
MASH.
And MASH.
He had a rock band.
But the thing he will always be known for is G.I. Joe. Because A, it is a sprawling, genuinely good, like, masterpiece of comics. And B, he's been on it for 250 issues over the course of, like, there was, what, a 10-year span? Where
something
he wasn't
like that,
on there?
Yeah.
Like 10 or 15 years. But he wrote, of the 155 issues of the original run, he wrote 150. Plus he wrote, I think, 35 of the 40 issues of Special Missions. Then he came back and wrote all of the, like, G.I. Joe Real American Heroes, starting with 155 and a half, that led into 156, and he's been on ever since.
And the kind of really crazy thing is that he didn't plan any of it out. Every single issue, he just, like, goes into it not knowing where it's going to end up, and he's like, I'm just going to write.
It is... That comic is so complicated, and the way those characters' lives interconnect is so twisting and interesting and complex. And someone asked him, this was an interview on CBR, someone asked him, how far ahead did you plot? And he said, 2 or 3 pages at most. Which makes sense, because if he's going to get a call from Hasbro, it's like, hey, we're going to introduce these new characters called Duke and Roadblock. You need to put them in the comic, and they need to be major characters. You don't want to have to derail your story.
Right. So they just show up at Destro's funeral and...
Yeah.
Or no, sorry, General Flagg's funeral and shoot at Baroness or whatever.
Yeah. And say, hey, your new character's Duke and Roblox. Here's how it's going to be from now on. So all of the sort of twisting complexity of G.I. Joe, which I genuinely think is on the level of like a Claremont's X-Men.
Oh, yeah.
Not planned. It is, which makes it even more impressive to me.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, you know, the golden era that I was talking about in the mid-80s, where you have things like a character, you know, the paratrooper Ripcord going off on a mission that turns into like a 15-issue arc where he ends up infiltrating Cobra's new island base that they raise out of the Gulf of Mexico so they can be a sovereign nation, and then somehow gets interchanged with Zartan. And like, there's some really amazing plotting going on, and knowing that it was just like him saying, well, basically like the comic book writer equivalent of sitting there with his little action figures, like smashing them together and saying, now what? It's all really impressive. And it all seems very suitable, like very appropriate for the nature of the property.
You're making me want to read this whole lot.
You should.
I only have a few issues of it.
I read the whole thing going up to like the current stuff about 4 or 5 years ago. So I read up to like 200. Like 1 to 200 plus special missions. It's worth it. It is a shockingly good book.
Yeah, I feel like if you read the comics up through the point where Andy Wiggum stops drawing, like that's
Rod
kind
Wiggum.
Of Rod Wiggum, yeah, sorry, and Andy Muschinski, that was the inker. Like their work, I don't know, they were just like a perfect combo for Hama's sort of approach to storytelling. And the art is kind of stiff, but it's all very technical and good, like, you know, very well positioned and framed and everything. Like, to me, that's kind of the golden era. Once you actually have G.I. Joe roll into Springfield and blow it up, then I feel like it kind of loses the plot a little bit. Huh. But up to that point, like everything leading up to issue 50 of the comic series, it really feels like a thoughtfully crafted story that has internal logic and consistency. And you're like, really, this is about a toy?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of really good stuff later in the run. Once you get past like 110, like 110 to 155 is a pretty rough stretch. Like,
at that point, Hasbro is like, this, you know, this line is faltering. Make it as kid friendly as you can.
All this is great, but did they have the plot arc where the G.I. Joe guys climb up the stairs and go up the Christmas tree like I did? That was the best one. Yeah, Destro fell off and cracked his head, and then
he's protected by beryllium steel. How did he crack his head?
It was a long fall.
Damn.
I mean, that was the world's largest Christmas tree.
But I will say this, the Snake Eyes trilogy, which happens, it's like in the late 90s. I think it's like 97, 98, 99 that's like a really good story. And then 100 is one of my favorite single issues of comics ever. That's the one where Cobra Commander.
That's the brainwashing in Broca Beach, right?
Yeah. In Millville.
Millville. Okay.
Yeah. Cobra Commander takes over a town because it is economically anxious. And he goes in and tells them that they need to make the town great again and not pay high taxes. And that he's just going to keep all the other people in from coming in and taking their jobs, and he'll pay them in cash and they won't have to pay taxes. And all these people are like, this Cobra Commander guy who's kicking a dog on page one sounds like he knows what he's talking about. And then they go get into the brainwashing machine.
Grabbed him by the puppy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I agree. There is a lot in the series that kind of taps into things, you know, cultural undercurrents that maybe we didn't recognize. But Hama's interesting because I think he was American born, but he is of Japanese descent and he served in the military in Vietnam. And a lot of, I feel like what you read in G.I. Joe beyond just like, oh, yeah, there's a lot of ninjas. Like it does have the sort of perspective on it that one, maybe someone who's a bit of a cultural outsider would experience. And two, a guy who served in a really, really crappy war, like a miserable, poorly justified war, would kind of bring to the table. Like we were talking about this at lunch before the podcast, but you know, if you look at Hama's writing in G.I. Joe, he's writing a military comic, but it seems to have a lot of respect for the individuals within the army, the people who go out and serve, but not a lot of respect for the institutions, for the military organizations themselves, for the politicians running the show, for the political motives behind everything. It's got a very cynical perspective from that point of view. And it really, I mean, you know, like if you know that Hama served in Vietnam, you understand why he writes that way.
That's interesting. This is a total tangent, but it's related to what you're saying, which is that there are other authors in the past who have served in wars who dedicate their careers to educating people about how bad war is, and they never want it to happen again, like All Quiet on the Western Front and like A Farewell to Arms by Hemingway. Is mm-hmm. like they're all meditations on how horrible it is, and they don't want it to happen again, you know. And this is when I was reading those in high school, I look back to G.I. Joe and I'm thinking there's a dissonance there, like this glorification of war as a toy, as a children's thing, and then actual reality of war. And I had no idea one of the writers of the comics was a veteran, you know.
Well, you know, I think Hama wanted to get the misery of conflict and serving, you know, to approach that as much as he could within the context of a comic book about a children's toy. Like mm-hmm. there's only so much he could do, but there's definitely a strong undercurrent there. I mean, we talked at lunch about October Guard, the Russian equivalent, the Soviet equivalent of G.I. Joe, and how, you know, in issue 6 of the comics, 6 and 7, there's like a two issue arc very early on in the run where he's still kind of figuring out what is G.I. Joe. And you have the G.I. Joe team with the October Guard sort of teaming up while competing with each other to track down a lost like satellite weapon that America had, you know, had fallen out of orbit and America needed to recover. They're in Afghanistan. So there's a lot happening there that is very like, you know, take that moment in history and kind of see like what's happening. And it's very interesting. But, you know, the whole thing at the very end, it turns out the Joe team, like what they were doing was actually just misdirection. Like they were sent to protect a fake satellite And basically, it didn't matter if Cobra got it or if the October Guard got it, because it wasn't the real thing. It was a distraction so the American army could go in and, or CIA, I guess, could go in and actually procure the real lost device. So the entire time, you know, the Joe team has been put into harm's way and put against both the terrorist organization and the elite soldiers from a rival nation at, you know, great personal potential for great personal harm to them. And it's all just a ruse. And at the very end, it's, you know, it's just Hawk walking away saying, you did a good job. And you see Stalker standing behind him, clearly looking not happy about it. But what can you do? Because that was the mission. So there's a lot of cynicism about, you know, the role of the military and the way people are used when they, you know, serve in the military within this comic. And I don't know that that necessarily comes through in the toy line, but you even do see that a little bit in some of the bio cards, alongside goofy jokes like, you know, Cutter's code name is Skip A. Stone, and Quick Kick was MacArthur Ito.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's like lots of little doofy jokes like that.
In terms of like its political leanings is that it's very pro-soldier, but it is also weirdly anti-war, because it is a military fantasy comic, but I like it's like 30% military, 70% fantasy, you know, like it is, it's not quite to the level of this, but it's about the military almost in the way that Star Trek is about the military, you know, like there's more to it, obviously. But there's a stretch of G.I. Joe where the prime antagonists for the team aren't necessarily Cobra. It's the Jugglers.
Yeah, the Pentagon.
Who are the guys at the Pentagon who are, you know, determining what they do. Those are the guys that have the
Snake Eyes
trilogy.
Weapon is the budget, basically.
Yeah. And there's always this push and pull between G.I. Joe and the Department of Defense, essentially. And it's not the conflict that you would expect to be in a comic that essentially is a big, you know, military here, our favorite soldiers comic. Because it's not like they're like, oh, they're not letting us go and kill whoever we want. It's very much like we are being mismanaged, we are being misused, and your inaction is allowing bad things to happen.
Yeah, I mean, the issue I was talking about, you know, later in the run where there's kind of the house clearing, that takes place in a very open analog for Saudi Arabia. And the Joe team is sent there to protect American interests. And no one's really happy about being there, about having to work with the local government. But, you know, that's the mission. That's the job. That's what they were sent to do. So, yeah, there's, you know, this stuff didn't come through, again, in the toy line or even in the cartoon. But there was, I think, more room for it to be sort of woven into the comic book, especially because, you know, I don't think Hasbro was paying as much attention to the comic book. It was like too many words to read.
Was there ever a bureaucrat action figure that you could...
There was a General Flag figure.
There's General Flag and there's Joe Colton.
Oh, there are a few Joe Colton characters. But he's not really a bureaucrat. He's like, he's the mascot. He's the figurehead.
He's the literal figurehead. Right. Yeah. But yeah, like Hasbro had no reason to ask for changes in G.I. Joe. It was huge. Like the comic was a huge hit. There's a something that surfaced a few years ago, and it was like a list that Jim Shooter had made of like what are Marvel's most important titles. Like it was every title Marvel was publishing a month. And that was like, how important are these to our bottom line? And it was based on how many stars they had. Amazing Spider-Man had 4 stars next to it, because it was like their top selling title in the mid 80s. So did G.I. Joe. Mm-hmm. Uncanny X-Men had 3.
Yeah. If you go back and look at ads, you know, the ads they run for like Mile High Comics or whatever in the mid 80s, there's a bunch of them that are like, G.I. Joe is the hottest comic of the 80s.
Yeah.
Like you have artwork of Wolverine standing next to it, but it says, G.I. Joe, get this. It's hot. Like the second issue of G.I. Joe used to sell for like 40, 50 bucks in the 80s.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Marvel was like, well, it's a toy line based comic. No one's going to buy it. So they put out a ton of issue 1, because that's what you always do. And then drop the order for number 2. And then the comic exploded in popularity. So all of a sudden everyone wanted issue two.
Yeah. Huh.
Which, by the way, focuses on a Russian psyops campaign to destabilize America. So, yeah, wow. Again, you're getting like these things that resonate with modern day history.
Yeah, Marvel put out a G.I. Joe yearbook every year that would just be like, hey, here's what happened in the last year's worth of G.I. Joe comics. They didn't do that for anything else. They didn't do that for X-Men, you know, which is a comic that probably could have used it. But I think it's, you know, kids were being lured in by the toys, by the cartoon. And, you know, the comics are very bright and colorful. And the cover to G.I. Joe number one is one of my favorite covers ever.
It's very iconic.
Where they're just jumping off a tank. And then you had stuff that was like being critically acclaimed, like number 21, the Silent Issue, Silent Interlude, which I love. And then I don't think there was a lot of turnover in kids who were reading G.I. Joe for a very long time. At one point, like at its height, they had 400,000 subscribers to G.I. Joe, which is huge.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
Any comic book would be happy to have 400,000 readers these days.
If there were 400,000 copies of a comic coming out.
Not even copies, just readers, like eyeballs on the page.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Half of that today, and you're a huge success. So.
Yeah, so G.I. Joe was big, and, you know, it did help that it had the cartoon on television. And the cartoon actually sprang out of advertisements for the toy and comic, because they would come up with these advertisements. Marvel's ad agency, Bacall or something, I can't remember, I wrote it down in the other notes, but they basically put together advertisements that tied the toy to the comic, and they would always end with like this animated sequence that had a freeze frame, and that was the comic that was coming out like next month. And you know, that's not how comic book schedules work. Animation schedules work on a much longer time frame than comic books. So basically, they would be given this comic cover and said, okay, you guys need to come up with a story that works for, you know, like here's the swamp skier and there's a little dragonfly helicopter shooting at it. So Hama, you figure out what that's about. And so they were kind of working backward in addition to all the other things they were doing. Like they were still kind of like figuring out how to work backward from these advertisements and figure out where do we work this into the story, this ongoing comic book military soap opera.
Yeah. And of course, if you've got a TV show that's on every day, and also there's a comic that's, you know, at the grocery store, at the drugstore, at the comic book store down the street, like, then that's a great ad for it.
Yeah, I was always like, there was like a little 15-second animation that looked just like the cartoon, and it would say, what happens next? Find out in Marvel Comics. And you saw the issue right there, so you were like, I gotta go to the store and find out what's going on. And usually the story in the comic didn't quite line up with the cartoon, but it didn't matter, because here was Duke and Zartan fighting each other. Here was, you know, they captured Cobra Commander. How do they do that? Like, gotta read. Let's find out.
Yeah. Here's Snake Eyes, who does nothing on the cartoon, but is, guess what? He's your new favorite dude.
He got radioactive once.
He also puts on a wig and dances over his ninja costume at one point in that first Dark Pyramid.
Yeah, Snake Eyes was definitely the breakout character for the comic and not the cartoon, because a character who doesn't speak and just wears solid black, not really a dynamic cartoon character, but you know that you were going to say.
Oh, I was going to say, should we talk about Silent Interlude and how like how big a deal that was?
I mean, Marvel did. You okay there?
Yeah.
All right. Marvel did have an entire month called Nuff Said, where everyone had to do their own Silent Interlude, which is a terrible corporate mandate, by the way. Like, who cares about artistic integrity? But it does speak to Silent Interlude's impact.
What is Silent Interlude?
Chris is going to tell you.
I know. It's G.I. Joe number 21. There are a lot of apocryphal stories about how it came out, but like one of the most famous being like, oh, it was over deadline, and so they didn't even have a chance to put the letters on the page. That is not true. Larry Hama had wanted for a while to experiment with doing a dialogue-free comic and see if he could pull it off. So, and Hama, in addition to being—
Not just dialogue, but also sound effect-free.
Sound effect free. Yeah, there's a computer screen readout at one point, but that's
it. That's the only word. That's not sound. That's like diegetic text.
Yeah. Hama was also an artist of, you know, so pretty
skilled. He's pretty good.
So he
He drew a few of the issues. Besides that one, he also drew like one of the Snake Eyes origin issues, I think, a few episodes later, a few months later.
So Larry Hama wrote and drew G.I. Joe 21, which is a story of Snake Eye. Scarlet gets kidnapped by Storm Shadow and taken to Destro's castle. And Snake Eyes, who doesn't talk, so it's very appropriate. It's a Snake Eyes spotlight story. Infiltrates the castle, rescues Scarlet, and they get away. And then it is revealed at the end that Storm Shadow and Snake Eyes have the same tattoo of their ninja clan. They have the same trigram tattoo, which of course becomes the driving force of the comic for the next 130 issues.
130, like 200.
For the next 200, like to this day, like the Arashikage ninja clan.
Yeah.
But Larry wrote and drew it. Steve Lealoa did the inks on it. And it was billed as like the most unusual comic of the year.
The strangest story ever, I think.
Because this was mainstream, high-selling, popular Marvel comics. You don't really see a lot of like format experiments in that kind of comic. A lot of that stuff comes from like, you know, lower selling titles where you know you can get away without the eyes
like
on it.
You get Swamp Thing or something. Yeah. Like that.
Which would have been contemporary to this. It's like the Alan Moore Swamp Thing. It went over huge. It is one of, like, I have a book that is a hardcover collection of that one issue that has the issue as it was printed, then it has Larry's layouts, and then it has the script in it. Because it is a fascinating piece of comics. It is a beautifully constructed comic. And it's literally like a ninja toy going through a castle playset to rescue another ninja toy. And it became kind of the signature of G.I. Joe. So I think maybe like 30 issues later, there's one that's just called SFX, where the only sounds, quote unquote, in the comic are sound effects.
He revisited that a few times. There was one in, I think, the third yearbook where Snake Eyes, I think, has to be rescued from the Cobra consulate. You know, this is by the point where Cobra is a sovereign nation and they have an embassy in the U.S. Like, Snake Eyes is captured and is imprisoned in the consulate so they can do some brainwashing on him. And so I think, if I'm not mistaken, Scarlet goes in and basically reverses the silent interlude.
Yeah.
But then a few issues, maybe like, I don't know, a year or two later, they did one that kind of did the same thing when it was Zartan chasing down the Arashikage ninjas in San Francisco.
That's the SFX.
Okay, okay.
Yeah. And then, of course, the silent castle becomes a bit, which I always thought was hilarious because they call it the silent castle in the comic like they knew it was the one in the issue where nobody talked.
Oh, that was the one where Snake Eyes didn't say anything, right?
Yeah, that was the silent castle. And that became very influential. Jeremy mentioned that Marvel did back in 2001.
Was it that long ago?
Yeah, it was during Morrison's New X-Men. It was 2001, 2002. Like Marvel did an event called Nuff Said, where every comic that month was a silent issue. And then also there have been different homages to it that are not in G.I. Joe. The Sixth Gun, the Cullen Bunn, Brian Hurt, like supernatural Western series. In the 21st issue of that series, the lead character, a gun goes off by her ears and she gets deafened. And so that whole issue is a silent issue. The cover is her in the Snake Eyes pose hanging off the side of a building.
Yeah, and you have stuff like the Hawkeye issue that's told from the perspective of the dog. So yeah. there's like people,
business.
Yeah, people talking, but it's just like, you don't actually know what they're saying. And it's all like pictograms and you know,
that sounds cool.
Dog level stuff. It's a great issue.
That is a great issue. But yeah, that all comes from Larry Hama, a genius.
Trying to sell toys.
Yeah.
I was going to say, Larry Hama sounds like the world's most interesting person.
Oh, he's super, like, he's a fascinating
He actually is. Like, they could do whiskey commercials about him.
Yeah.
Beer commercials.
But I mean, like, I think that is the level of, like, again, I went back and read the entire run as an adult. And I grew up with the cartoon. I was never really into the toys until I was an adult. And I never really got into the comic and, like, reread the whole thing until I was in my 20s and they were putting out the complete collections. Because for so long it was just out of print.
Right. Yeah, I got into the comic late. Like, it was after the cartoon had ended. I watched the cartoon religiously every afternoon. Bought a bunch of the toys. My brother bought a bunch of the toys. He ended up going into the Navy, so probably had some influence there. And then I think a friend of mine, when I was in elementary school, brought the issue with, I think it's the one where Sergeant Slaughter makes his debut. So like 48 or so. Mm-hmm. It's the one where the cover is like Zartan holding some guy. I think gung-ho, like holding him by the throat and like sneaking through the pit. So Zartan has, you know, infiltrated G.I. Joe headquarters, the hidden pit that no one is supposed to know where it is. So that was the first issue I read, and it was amazing. It's like super well constructed, and it's this like great story about toys. And from that point on, I would pick up the comic whenever I could. So around maybe like a year later, I finally, you know, started going to comic shops regularly and could pick up the issues instead of just finding them occasionally at the grocery store.
Says a lot about that comic is that there's a couple dozen characters on each side. Like, obviously, Duke, after he shows up, is a big deal all the way through.
In the comic?
In the
comic.
Not really. Well, no. He's there, I guess I should say.
He's
Snake Eyes is a big deal.
He's like the field commander, but Hawk never stopped being the leader in the comics.
Hawk's a big deal. Stalker is a big deal. Snake Eyes is a big deal. You know, like, Roadblock is a big deal. But of the, like, again, a couple dozen characters on every side, everybody has a pretty distinct voice and is like, for characters that are all kind of like talking in the same military jargon, because there's a lot of like a lot of footnotes explaining what all the abbreviations are.
Right. He tried to make it sound like authentic dialogue that you would use in the military.
Yeah. Characters come off as like really distinct and they have personality, even when it's, you know, even when it's just like, oh, okay, Snowjob's around for like three issues because we got to sell that figure.
Right. But at the same time, you don't have characters defined in broad strokes like they are in the comic or in the cartoon. You don't have Bazooka dumb as a post. Like, he's the, his bio card is like, he's the guy who's a genius at ballistics and he can do math in his head. And then the cartoon, he's like, Dav Bazooka. So, you know, it's much more down to earth plotting than that.
Yeah. Like Destro and Cobra Commander and Baroness are all like really strong and well developed characters. And to its credit, like, that is a book that probably had more named female characters with developed personalities in starring roles than a lot of other comics of the era.
Well, I mentioned this in the other podcast I did, but if you look at the top three characters in the cartoon who have the most dialogue, it's Cobra Commander, Lady J, and the Baroness.
Yeah.
Like, it's two women and one guy. And that's, I think, a reflection of sort of the creative teams who worked on these series. Like, you know, originally Scarlet, when they were developing the figure, her military specialty was just girl. Mm-hmm. She was just the girl. Like, you had to throw a girl in there. But she became a critical character both on the cartoon and in the comic.
You know, I think Lady J was one of my favorite characters in the cartoon.
Yeah, she was great.
And Hawk? Hawk was the guy with the beret, right?
Or the, no, that's no, Flint. The beret.
Flint.
Hawk
Flint.
Barely had any
Who's
role
Hawk?
In the comic.
Who's the...
Hawk, you didn't really see Hawk in the cartoon until the second version of the figure with the bomber jacket and the helmet. His original version actually came, like the toy came with a laser gun, like this big laser installation. So you didn't really, like, I didn't know a lot of people who had Hawk. But he was a big character in the comic because Hamad conceived him as
he was the
team
kid.
Leader.
Yeah.
But the cartoon didn't start until after they had brought out Duke as a character. So Duke got top billing because he was kind of like, you know, the Hawk replacement. He was it didn't make a lot of sense to have
to
a colonel out on the field and eventually a general like shooting lasers at people. But it did make sense to have a top shirt, you know, for a sergeant who was out there as the field commander. So Duke became sort of like the lead figure.
Duke is the blonde haired guy. Right?
Yeah, but they had to change Hawk's hair because Hawk was also originally blonde. Okay. And then when Duke came in, they were like, Hawk has brown hair.
Yeah.
Oh, is that why there's two different toys? Isn't there two different toys of Hawk?
There's two different toys of a lot of people.
There's many different Hawks. There's also like the space soldier Hawk.
Wow.
When they started getting weird in the late 80s, early 90s.
Ironically,
with like weird figures.
That one doesn't have a laser gun, right?
I believe opposite. He does have a laser gun.
It's like a six shooter.
But like along the same lines, like it is also, I literally cannot think of another comic from the 80s that has that much of a racially diverse cast either. Like, I mean,
Roadblock doesn't talk in rap in the comic book.
In the comic book. He's a gourmet chef.
He is.
He's like, but to put it in very blunt terms, I can't think of another superhero comic or mainstream comic that had two Native Americans in it in the 80s and G.I. Joe does. And it's, and again, it's a sort of like traditional Native American character in the form of Spirit, who's the tracker, of course, but there's also Alpine.
Oh,
who's,
you're forgetting, wears a blue vest, Airborne.
Airborne, yeah. Not Alpine. Okay, Airborne.
Yeah.
Airborne.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a different kind of Native American. Like, his family is rich on oil wealth.
Yeah,
they're like landowners.
So you got like a lot of like, you know, a lot of racial diversity, a lot of class diversity. Like in an interesting way that I think probably comes, I mean, obviously comes from television, and you know, we need to cover all our marketable bases.
What about Larry Hama? Don't you think he's responsible for that?
I mean,
diversity and stuff.
Probably so. Yeah.
I would say so. I mean,
you're saying he's I'm sure the descent, and so he's,
yeah, but you know, I think a lot of that does come just from the idea of like, well, we've got all these toys we need to sell to lots of different people. Huh. We'll have the obligatory, here's the female character for this year. We have like the obligatory two African American characters for this year. I really think that was just like demographics, you know, designing for the toys. But Hama was the one who decided like the female characters are all going to be important.
Cover Girl, who was a model before she joined G.I. Joe, is going to be a tank mechanic.
Right. I love that.
Yeah.
But yeah, like almost all the female characters, both, you know, Cobra and G.I. Joe, have major roles in both comics and cartoons. He's, you know, Hama's the one who decided like Stalker, an African American, is going to be, and Roadblock, an African American. Like, these are going to be major figures in the comic.
It also has like a weird effect on Cobra. Because Cobra, like you said, it's not Hydra, but, you know, Hasbro had a rule against making any black villains. Like, Jetta from Jem was originally meant to be a black character, and they told Christy Marks, no, you can't. You can't put a black character on the bad guy team. So Jetta wasn't. Jetta was white on Jem. The same thing goes for G.I. Joe, where everybody on G.I. Joe is white. So, and when they...
You mean everyone in Cobra?
Or, yeah, sorry. Everyone in Cobra is white. So when you get to the point where they're literally manufacturing, they have like factories that are making Freds, who are these blonde-haired, blue-eyed, average American sleeper agents, that it's like, they do get this weird white supremacist like undercurrent that I think is actually really interesting. Because you know, once you get like different reboots of G.I. Joe going into the 2000s, I remember... Firefly was black in the IDW continuity. And I remember a friend of mine being like, oh, that's weird. But not in a way of like, oh, they're making Firefly black now. It wasn't one of those. It was just like, oh, Cobra was kind of subtly a white supremacist organization for 20 years.
Well, a lot of it, you know, in the file cards, they were characters drawn from all over Europe mostly. Mm-hmm. You had like The Crimson Guard, the Crimson Twins were from Corsica, ha ha ha, the Corsican Twins. The Baroness was of some mysterious Eastern European descent. Firefly, I can't remember exactly where he had been from, but Major Blood, I think, was Irish.
Sebastian Blood?
Yeah, Sebastian Blood. Yeah. Yeah, so Destro, Scottish.
Destro, Scottish. Laird James McCullen Destro the 24th.
Exactly, yeah.
My boy.
So yeah.
That's
like
his full name?
Yep.
The idea is like it's, you know, the old world versus the new almost.
Yeah. There's America versus everybody.
Pretty much.
In a way that is really interesting.
Although you did have, you know, the October Guard eventually did join forces with G.I. Joe once Glasnost happened.
Yeah.
And you got occasional like guys from other countries like Big Ben showing up from the UK.
Were
but
there
yeah,
any
it was
Russian
American.
Pun names? Like,
not really. Horror show.
I can't remember which names I'm thinking of are from G.I. Joe and which character names I'm thinking of are from those Firestorm comics where there's a Russian Firestorm in the 80s.
Yeah, I don't know. When I was a kid, I remember arguing with my brother that there was a character named Blowjob.
All right. Well, I think that's a great place to pause. And we should probably start talking about the video games. You were wrong.
Good.
There was
I killed
the
torch
and there was
Thank
snow
you.
Job,
yes.
But do not put the two together.
There was Big Lob.
It's like, there that's
was.
Not like, you know, but I'm like,
there was cool
there's
breeze.
A, it's a fan thing with fans, blowing fans. I was like six. I had no idea.
Okay. Well, that's forgivable then. You probably had seen a lot of, you know,
you
Ken Starr and Clinton and
probably saw the movie and like, you know, Big Lob makes his play. It's very easy to mishear Big Lob.
I think I was thinking of Snow Job.
Probably.
Yes. Yeah. All right. So we've talked a lot about that stuff. Let's take a break and then talk about the video games, which is what everyone's here to hear. Woo. Kind of didn't talk about the games yet, which is bad. So we need to power through that because this was supposed to be like a Retronauts micro, which doesn't exist anymore, but still a shorter episode. Anyway, I'm not helping matters here any by rambling. So let's jump immediately to the reader mailbag and let you guys talk. So our first letter comes from Matt. Yes, name's Matt. Instead of G.I. Joe, when I was a kid, I opted for Hasbro's other 80s powerhouse property, Transformers. All I knew about G.I. Joe was that it had a catchy theme song and that some kid in my class had meticulously cataloged all the backing cards of his endless collection of Joe action figures. It was literally all he talked about, kind of like me. One night during my first winter break in college, I microwaved a couple of hot dogs and sat on my parents' couch, remote in hand. That's when I stumbled upon G.I. Joe on some 100-plus numbered cable channel. It was the TV equivalent of new old stock, a kind of comfort food I'd never eaten before. It was a miniseries, I guess, starring Shipwreck as one of the leads. And it was awesome. I stayed up the next few nights to catch an episode or two. It was sort of a way to explore the ultra-patriotism of the 80s at a time when a lot of people my age felt like democracy had failed them. But it was mostly about sweet explosions, and I'm okay with that. That was not about video games, but that's okay. Maybe your first comment there on the comments is?
This one comes from Danny Bergman, who says, G.I. Joe was my toy of the 80s and 90s and even some today. To my 8-year-old self, Larry Hama's comic book stories were so mature and unlike other media for kids. The NES video games seemed to arrive at the dusk of the Real American Hero line, but I'm glad I got to play both and enjoyed the mix of abilities and swapping of characters. It's why I actually bought a Captain Gridiron figure, hand grenade, footballs, and everything.
Oh, man.
Love Captain Gridiron's. Yeah. Like, we haven't even talked about how there's a second G.I. Joe animated series that was like season 4.
Poop.
Got to get tough. Yo, Joe.
Oh, I remember bad. That.
Yeah. That was season 3, I think. I think there were only 2 Marvel Sunbow. They were very long, though. It was like 50 yeah. episodes apiece.
Long seasons. But yeah. Like, it's. I actually have those on DVD, too. They're quite awful.
Yes. let's see. From Alfonso J. Rivera. My strongest G.I. Joe memory is the NES soundtrack of the first G.I. Joe game in that system. As a kid back in the early 90s, this is the game that truly made me appreciate the glorious and amazing chiptunes of licensed NES games. While wishful thinking on my part, I hope that someday we can see an official release of the soundtrack and other hidden gems of the NES era.
Next one comes from Bonsell in the UK, maybe. In the UK, G.I. Joe was called Action Force when it was first introduced. I don't think the cartoon was ever shown on TV, and the movie went straight to video here. We had the Marvel Comics though, and they were pretty popular in my playground, especially the issues about Snake Eyes and Storm Shadow. My main memory is reading a comic that centered on the Sky Striker coming to a respectful stalemate with a Cobra jet plane.
That's a good one.
That's a good one.
I had to have a Sky Striker after that, and I was delighted to get one that Christmas. My other main memory is of my brother and I unscrewing the action figures and swapping their body parts around. I did that.
Yes.
I had a special screwdriver just for that with all the little rubber bands around it.
because I just swapped them out.
I messed up so many figures that way.
Yeah, I mean, that was like the second life of the figures.
I had some figures that are very, very valuable now, like Snake Eyes. Yeah, he got Frankenstein with major blood.
That's like, I can't even imagine doing
that. No, Snake Eyes with like a bionic arm, it was so cool.
That is cool. Because we could, he said. Or she, I'm not sure. I remember that eventually the branding was changed to G.I. Joe to be consistent. But like the NES, G.I. Joe was never as popular in the UK as it was in the US. I wonder why. A real American.
They were international heroes. I had some G.I. Joe from Japan once upon a time, and it was like G.I. and then in Japanese written Joe, and it was international heroes.
Wow.
Yeah. They even put it in the theme song. It's the same amount of syllables.
Mm-hmm. Real international heroes.
International hero.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, and actually that Skyscraper Striker episode of, or issue of the comic kind of gets to, the real sort of origins of G.I. Joe. Like when Hasbro first launched it, the characters were secondary. It was really about the ships, the vehicles.
Toys.
It was the toys obviously, but like not specifically the figures, but rather the vehicles. The figures were, you know, drivers. They were sort of a secondary consideration, but instead, they're actually what took off because they were so well defined through the cartoon, the comic, the file cards. So obviously, like the vehicles were really cool. You know, I'm sure all of us had, except maybe you, Chris. Like my brother had the Sky Striker, and I had the Rattler, the Cobra equivalent, sort mm-hmm. of. Somehow I ended up with all the Cobra stuff, and that's okay.
The only one I ever had was the Night Raven.
He had the Night Raven was pretty cool.
Yeah,
the SR-71.
I had that one, I think.
Yeah, I had the Cobra More, and then he had the hydrofoil. That was the hydrofoil. He had the hovercraft, the whale. So it was kind of like the good guy bad guy thing. You got to have this parity between the toys if you had a sibling. So that was kind of nice.
Yeah. I bought all the new ones though when they came out with the anniversary line. So I had the Trouble Bubble and the
But they never reissued some of the big stuff. Like the whale never got a reissue. I think the More did, but it was kind of bad.
The Sky Striker got reissued. The weird thing was, they were all new figures, but they used the same molds for the vehicles, so the figures didn't quite fit.
Yeah, I think in hindsight, my favorite G.I. Joe toys were the ones that were like Sears exclusive. I don't know if you ever saw those. If you looked in the Sears catalog in the mid 80s, they'd always have like special exclusive G.I. Joe toys. And they were just like the standard toys, but molded in different colors. There was one year where they had this like two sets of Dreadnought vehicles. And they were just like the standard Dreadnought or the standard G.I. Joe vehicles, like a Jeep and a helicopter. But they were molded in this weird plastic. It was like dark blue and dark green. And then some of it was this light green that changed color in sunlight because that was the Zartan gimmick.
Yeah. Cool.
And it smelled like chocolate. It was the weirdest thing. It was like this chocolate scented plastic. Those things sell for like $500 or $600 now.
Yeah. They're I remember rare. Those. I'm pretty sure because we all worshiped those catalogs as kids.
So let's see. Our family says Zach Adams was a little behind the times as far as games went. We were still scrounging Atari games from garage sales in our small town's one used game shop until summer 1988. I had memories of seeing the G.I. Joe game in ads on TV, and especially in comics where Parker Brothers had held the inside back cover slot for most Marvel books for a period of a year or two. I really wanted to play it, but never saw it in the store. When we finally found a loose copy at the used game shop and I asked about it, the old man who ran the store started yelling about how it was nonsensical garbage, and his rule was that if any customer could show him how to play the game, he'd give it to them for free. That was more than enough to warn 9-year-old me off of it. I still don't know how it works 30 years later. Anything else on the site?
Scott Scosi writes in to say, the second NES game, The Atlantis Factor, gets unfairly overlooked. I maintain that it is superior to the original. I loved the Bionic Commando-like map, which gave players a lot of freedom in how to tackle the game's challenges. You go get the laser gun first, or try to recruit a third Joe like Roadblock or Storm Shadow, who is a Joe in this game.
He often was.
Yeah. Because, you know, he only joined Cobra to find out who killed the Hard Master.
It was Zartan.
There is some trial and error in learning the best routes and which characters to use, but not much more than learning a boss order in Mega Man. It helps that it was one of the few games that I owned that I could beat. I understand it featured some lesser characters in its cast, but as someone who was just too young to really get into G.I. Joe as a kid, that didn't bother me. It still had Duke and Snake Eyes, and you still fought Destro and Cobra Commander, which was pretty much the extent of my G.I. Joe knowledge.
All right, and we'll wrap the letter section with this from Tommy. Not Tommy Arashikage.
Not Tommy Arashikage, no. Storm Shadow?
Nope, I don't think so. I think it's, his last name's on here, and it's not Arashikage. G.I. Joe, Real American Hero, and G.I. Joe Atlantis Factors are example of doing licensed games right. The first game is a great action-adventure where each Joe has unique weapons, and each one feels different to use, whether it's Snake Eyes with his high-jumping weapon that takes no ammo, or Rock and Roll with his Contra-style spread-shot weapon, and General Hawk with his jetpack. The second game introduces a Bionic Commando-style map, and some divergence in the way you can approach the game as far as underwater areas with wetsuit and passages you can crawl through with roadblock. Personally, I feel overall, the first game is better in terms of the way it feels, and the music is fantastic. And that is actually a really great segue into talking about the video games. So it looks to me like there have basically been five classic G.I. Joe games and two Action Force spinoffs that only happened in the UK, which we'll talk about briefly. But most of the games are okay, and then there are a couple that I think are very, very good. Let's start with one of the okay ones, which is Cobra Strike for Atari 2600 from 1983. So a tie-in with the early comic book, and I think it slightly predates the cartoon. But, you know, a 2600 tie-in to the toy line that, according to, there's a Wikipedia quote on here that says, Jeremy Parrish of Retronauts blog felt that this game had about as much to do with a G.I. Joe as any other licensed game from that era, which is to say, not a whole hell of a lot. And that sounds like a great expert opinion to me.
Yeah. I put that in there, by the way. Just kidding.
I don't know.
No?
I feel like I've never played this game. I've seen it. I've screenshots of it.
I've tried playing it.
Probably tried it, but it's not memorable enough to remember actually what happens.
Yeah, like the guy, Zach Adams, who wrote in and said there was an old man who shouted at him that this game is nonsensical garbage. Mm-hmm. I can't disagree. I've tried playing it and I'm just like, so, okay, you like control a shield or something in this game. So at the bottom of the screen, there's two barracks and there's G.I. Joe dudes running from one side of the barracks to the other. You know, they're all just stick figures. So it could be Scarlet, it could be Cobra Troopers, who knows? Anyway, above you, there is a giant cobra, which admittedly looks pretty cool for an Atari 2600 graphic, but it's waving just like my arm is here. You can't see it at home, but trust me, I'm hypnotizing both Benj and Chris. Wake up, guys. Wake up.
Sorry.
So this snake head hovers over the top of the screen and drops venom at you, and you're like blocking it, but you're also, there's guns on the side of the screen and you're like trying to shoot the snake.
That's what snakes do. They drop venom.
That's but not they're really giant what G.I. Joe is about.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it really feels like they just had a game concept and were like, well, I guess we could attach this to the G.I. Joe property. Why not? Hmm. It doesn't feel as, as well considered as something like E.T.
To be fair, almost every Atari game released in 1983 was horrible and nonsensical.
That's
garbage.
True.
Almost every. Not all of them, but yeah.
Much better, on the other hand, was G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero for Commodore 64, which launched 2 years later. And this is one I've never actually played, but I've always wanted to. Have you guys ever played this one?
No.
I have not, no. It looks pretty fun, though.
Ben, you're like the PC guy. I'm really surprised you haven't played this one.
Let me take a look at it and see.
So this is like I had a friend tell me about this.
Oh.
Wow.
Sorry.
That's a pretty great rendition of the theme.
So I had a friend tell me about this game years later, and I did not believe them when they were telling me about this game where you start out and you get to pick one of eight Cobras and one of 12 G.I. Joes and go fight wherever you want. I was like, this game did not exist. That sounds way too cool to have ever existed. But no, it did exist. And it's basically like this endless toy box. According to some interviews I read online, the idea was to basically give you like a chance to, you know, again, smash your toys together, but in computer form. So you would have a duel between a G.I. Joe guy and a Cobra guy, and there would be like some sort of Cobra AI asset helping out, like a little one of those little tracked mini vehicles, or like a Cobra soldier popping out who would shoot at you, or the snake armor. So, there's not really that much to it, but it seems okay.
Yeah, it looks neat.
It looks like G.I. Joe.
Just now watching a video of it, and it looks pretty darn amazing for a game.
1985 C64 game. Yeah. In addition to the top down shooter sections where you're running around on foot trying to fight a Cobra guy, you also have some almost like Radon Bungling Bay style sequences where you control one of four vehicles and have to go blow up a Cobra base, and it's like a top down vehicular mode, and you have two aerial craft and two ground based vehicles that you can choose from.
Wow.
And they, you know, they operate by their specific rules. Like the what is it called? The Vamp Jeep has to drive on the ground, so you have to steer around trees and stuff. But if you fly a Dragonfly helicopter, then you can just fly over the trees. So it's kind of cool. It's like, I feel like they did a lot with this.
There's a lot of graphical detail here that's really impressive.
Yeah, it's really cool. Weird bunch of characters too. Like you mentioned that it's pretty much every named Cobra.
To that point, yeah.
Up to that point. But like also the cast of good guys is, there's also eight of them. And so you get like
There's 12. There's 12. Plus four vehicle drivers.
So you get Zap and Recondo. Like what a weird bunch of Joes.
I mean, it's basically like everyone who was interesting through 1984. They left out a lot of the green shirts from the first wave of G.I. Joes.
So Grunt.
Yeah, Grunt. I mean, he got to be on the Marvel Comics display box in the upper left-hand corner of every freaking issue of G.I. Joe. So how poor Grunt was he really? Also, he's the only one who like fell in love.
He got out of the army.
Yeah, he met Lola.
Yeah.
She jogs.
She does.
So I also appreciate the fact that there is differentiation between the characters. Like if you fight Baroness, she's using her little laser gun, or actually like huge laser rifle. But if you fight Scrap Iron, he's actually blasting missiles at you across the screen.
That's pretty cool.
I don't know how different those are in terms of game mechanics, but at least, you know, they paid attention to the cosmetics. And again, you know, it's like every named character up through 1984. So the first 3 years of the toy line. And it is a virtual toy box, basically.
Yeah.
And you can't lose the game, but you also can't win the game. You just keep playing and facing off like, I want Snake Eyes to fight Firefly this time, you know, to put that Arashikage grudge to rest that we'll find out in 8 years. I don't know. I feel like I'm really sad that I missed out on this one. And I don't know if you guys have seen that new C64 mini that's coming out, but I'm really hoping I can hack other games onto that thing and finally have a chance to play G.I.
Cool,
Joe.
Because the original C64s practically all don't work anymore.
Right.
The ones I have, I had to take apart five of them just to make one working C64 recently.
So on the computer tip here, we have in 1988, Action Force and Action Force 2. And these happened only in the UK and only on the ZX Spectrum. And they are as idiomatic as you would expect, you know, from a late 80s game for Spectrum. They are very kind of simplistic looking, but I feel like they're kind of ambitious. It's basically like a gumshoe clone. Have you guys checked this out?
No,
I'm sure it's not gumshoe. I'm thinking of the
for NES.
NES.
Yeah.
No, I'm thinking of a different one. I'm thinking of a like point and click adventure game. Sorry.
Okay. No, I'm thinking gumshoe for NES.
Deja vu. Yeah.
That's very different.
Very confused.
Both of these games star Quick Kick, just Quick Kick, just the silent weapons expert who was created as a He was a weird character. He was created for the cartoon, and he wasn't like a military guy. He was an aspiring actor who joined G.I. Joe when like a mission encountered him filming videos or filming commercials for Fudgy Bars. And they were like, hey, guy who was selling frozen snacks in the Arctic, why don't you join our secret military team of highly specialized experts?
I said a lot of really good things about the diversity in G.I. Joe. And I like Quick Kick as a character. I really do. But he is egregiously stereotypical. He's the G.I. Joe who does not wear shoes or a shirt. Mm-hmm. Because he's, you know, he's a silent weapons karate master.
Right.
No shoes for him.
Right.
But I do believe, I might have this wrong, but I believe Quick Kick was one of the characters who was heavily featured in the Action Force comics, which were the European G.I. Joe comics.
Probably.
Which were, they were reprinted in America as European missions.
Yes.
I have never been able to track down a run, and those do not get
reprinted. I found a few of those back in the day, but I did not keep them.
I've got one that has Destro on the cover getting pointed at by a bunch of weird hands coming in from weird angles.
You know those the extended UK Transformers run by Simon Furman, and how that's like legend and basically people love it more than the American stuff?
Yeah.
G.I. Joe doesn't have that. That's not Action Force.
But I do know that there was a obscure Grant Morrison two-pager where Quick Kick talked about learning Kung Fu from Shang-Chi. Because like they were introducing Master of Kung Fu into the Action Force magazine. It was going to have like G.I. Joe lead stories and then Master of Kung Fu backups. So the transition was Morrison having Quick Kick talk about Shang-Chi and how cool he was and getting all the kids hype. So I think Quick Kick was heavily featured on that side.
Okay. Well, in the American comics, he showed up, let's see, when Storm Shadow broke into the G.I. Joe base, the pit, and he got beaten down so Storm Shadow could be like, I'm awesome. And then he was on a mission to Eastern Europe into Barovia that went horribly wrong, and he ended up in a gulag for like 2 years. And then he went to Trucial Abysma, the stand-in for Saudi Arabia, and died.
Yeah.
So he didn't really get a good treatment in the comic because he was not invented by Larry Hama.
So. Got a cool figure, though.
It was a pretty good figure. My brother had that one.
He comes with nunchucks and a sword.
I think my favorite character of Asian descent in G.I. Joe is Tunnel Rat because the figure is made to look like Larry Hama.
Larry Hama.
And that's awesome. Also, he's short, which I appreciate that. So moving on to my personal favorite on the list, which is G.I. Joe for NES. One of you said that he didn't like this one. That's you, Chris. What the hell is wrong?
I feel like it's, I didn't realize this was a hot take. But
it is a very hot take.
But I have played this game. I just don't find it very fun. Maybe I'm completely wrong and I should go back and revisit it more often. But like,
that's correct.
I remember getting it when I was a kid and not liking it then. I remember like getting it when I got into emulation around the turn of the century and not really enjoying it then. And I remember checking it out just recently and being like, it's not really what I want out of G.I. Joe. So maybe it's just me. Maybe I just have, maybe where's Captain Gridiron in this game?
He's one of the playable characters. No.
Where's Big Lob?
Big Lob, you'll never see him.
where's the Toxo Viper?
I think you do fight Toxo Vipers.
Then never mind.
Yeah. You definitely fight sea vipers or bugs or whatever they're called.
Bugs. This game always struck me as just a generic action platformer in the same vein as.
Yeah.
Did you guys get past the
Batman,
first stage?
Kabuki Quantum Fighter.
It's not as good as Kabuki Quantum Fighter.
You know, all this, you got a little guy jumping around, shooting, Ninja Gaiden, Gaiden, whatever you say. I think I rented it when it came out. I was excited that there was a new G.I. Joe game. And
Did you guys get past the first stage? Because
probably
once you
not,
get to the second stage, it gets really interesting. So the first stage, it's like linear. You're just a guy going through the jungle and fighting cobras who attack you. And then you fight a cobra condor at the end because, of course, like, you know, a two-part stealth plane is going to be attacking a guy in the ground. Anyway, you know, it's very much a vehicle for the vehicles of the era, the figures in vehicles, trying to sell those. But once you get to the second stage, the second part of the first stage, the second segment of the first mission, then it stops being just a side scroller and becomes sort of a free roaming space where you have to travel throughout a Cobra base and find weak points where you place bombs and you have a set amount of time to place the bombs. And then the third mission is you getting the heck out of there before the bombs go off.
Yeah, I remember that being very difficult.
Really?
Am I wrong? Am I bad at video games?
I mean, it's not an easy game, but I don't think it's unreasonably difficult. It's one of those that I rented or I bought back then and finished it within the weekend and was like, oh, well, I guess I'll keep playing over and over again.
Yeah, I remember renting it and not being able to make a lot of progress into it.
Well, the thing I like about this game is that it really does sort of take the G.I. Joe concept into consideration. For each mission, you have a mission commander who is like the fixed character for that mission. And then you can choose two characters to take along with you. And each character has their own strengths and weaknesses. So I think one of the letters got to this, like Snake Eyes is very physically fragile. He can't take a lot of hits, but he can jump really high. And he's the only character whose weapon doesn't use ammo because he shoots like Hadouken, basically, as he did in the comics. He also has a you have two
Jeremy
kinds of attacks.
Saw me leaning into the mic on that
one. You have two kinds of attacks. You have melee and ranged attacks, and then you can throw grenades. So you can like walk around with Snake Eyes and stab people with swords, or you can throw fireballs or ki attacks, I guess. So each character has their own strengths and weaknesses. Like the writer said, Rock and Roll it's the second generation Rock and Roll. So he's got the guns that are like the size of a car engine. And those shoot a spread. And each character, as you play, you can collect power ups and their weapons become stronger. So it gets like better range and better attack power. I don't know. I think it's really well done. They threw in some vehicles in there. Some of the small vehicles of the era, like the Buzz Boar, allows you to actually like ride around on the ceilings and the walls. And then, you know, every boss is a named Cobra character or vehicle. So you fight Raptor, you fight, I think Scrap Iron, no, Metalhead, because Scrap Iron was out, Metalhead was in. I don't know. I just feel like it's a really well-made game. It's by Kid, who also created Low G-Man, which is not great, Burai Fighter, which is great. They were a pretty solid developer. It was kind of produced by Ken Lobb, who you may know from GoldenEye or works at Microsoft now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know. I like it. Sounds I'm familiar. A big fan.
Yeah.
I am glad you enjoy it.
I don't know. I guess I couldn't get into it. I had a prejudice against licensed games for a long time, probably because there were so many horrible ones. They would just churn out a license of some sort of movie.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, I was the same way, but... So I was still able to look past the prejudice and say, like, this is a great game, which this is. There's also the sequel to that, G.I. Joe the Atlantis Factor, which is made by the same developer.
There's a good game.
You're wrong. That was made by the same developer, but instead of being published by Taxan, it was published by Capcom. I don't know what happened there. It's kind of weird, but I feel like it's not as good. It's kind of G.I. Joe in reverse, where the first game gives you all these characters you can pick from. The sequel, you can only control Hawk at the beginning, and you have to find the other characters. So it's more limited at the start. It's also really like this one is much harder than the first one.
Yeah, I could not get
it's brutally this difficult.
Yeah. And I tried.
So, Benj, why do you think it's a great game?
I feel like just presentation wise, it had more polish than the first one. It actually felt like a Capcom game, even though it was developed by, you know,
I feel like it looks exactly the same personally.
Yeah. Well, I'm wrong.
No, I mean, maybe you're right. Maybe I'm just so prejudiced against it.
Maybe I was prejudiced by the Capcom name, and I'm like, wow, this is like Mega Man.
Something interesting. Okay.
I don't have a lot to say, but I mean, I played it here and there, you know, every once in a while, and it doesn't stick with me. So it's nothing as good as a Larry Hama comic book.
Well, no, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah, these games do lack a sophisticated narrative, which is what I want to G.I. Joe.
That's true.
They're so stumpy. The little guys are so short, and there's something weird about it. You know,
I like that though. I like having more room to maneuver. Like Mega Man, they're the same size as Mega Man. They're small on screen, and there's a lot of stuff happening around you.
But he's a little boy.
Mega Man's like 3 feet tall.
He's a robot.
He's a boy.
He's a robot.
He's a fighting robot.
He is.
A 3 foot tall fighting robot.
Okay, well, there was never a game comparable to the comic book, but there was a game comparable to the cartoon, and that's what we're going to end this episode on, because it's freaking great. And Chris, I feel like you have some things to say about this.
Yeah, this game rules. This is the arcade game G.I. Joe from 1992.
Binge, do you know this one? Have you played it?
Not that I know of.
Oh, you missed out.
I did not.
I might remember it.
This is basically a Devastator's clone, if you remember that game, or something like Cabal or whatever. Like, it's you run into the screen and just blow the hell out of things.
Yeah.
That's all it is. It's dumb and stupid and mindless, and I love it.
First of all, like, all the art for it looks dope.
Yeah. It looks exactly like the cartoon.
Yeah. I did not know this game existed until like 4 or 5 years ago when I was over at a friend's house, and like, he had one of those custom arcade cabinets, and it was one of the games. And I was like, G.I. Joe for the arcade. I'll play this.
I don't know how this happened, but the pizza place that my family liked to go to for lunch after church on Sundays. I feel like a lot of the games that I remember, like RoboCop or the Goonies, you know, on the PlayChoice 10, I remember from there. And this is one that they had. They had G.I. Joe, and this came out in, what, 1992? So by that point, I was like, yeah, I'm done with G.I. Joe. That's a kid's stuff. And it's based on the cartoon from like 7 years before, but it's so perfectly done that I didn't care. I was like, wait a minute. This is scratching my childhood nostalgia right here, and I'm still a teenager. What's happening?
It is a weird game to come out in 1992. Because again, like, G.I. Joe was not a going concern at the time. Like, even the toys were winding down.
They were winding down. The cartoon was over. The comic book was on autopilot. Yeah.
All the characters were dead.
A handful of them were.
This looks slightly familiar, like I've seen this at one point. But yeah. Maybe I'm just thinking of like Space Harrier, where you're behind the, you know, it's you're this guy's running forward and you're seeing a third person over the shoulder view, and you're almost super scalar technology.
Yeah, I mean, it's very super scalar.
Run at a Cobra base and kill everybody. It looks
pretty darn cool, but I don't know if I've actually played it.
Everything that you're fighting is straight from the cartoons. There's like hiss tanks coming out and rattlers flying overhead, and then you get to a base and Baroness is at the top and she's like shooting at you and throwing grenades and stuff.
Everything looks exactly like what it is, which is pretty great. But then shortly after I had played this on one of those emulator cabinets, I was in Minneapolis and I went to a barcade up there, I think called Up Down, and they had one there, and it is a bright and shiny quarter muncher. It is like it is one of those games where the primary skill is having quarters, but it is super fun. Like, I thought it was a blast.
Yeah, it's not a deep game by any means, but it's just like super mindless and super high energy. There's just so much stuff happening at all times. And it is like just such a perfect distillation of the Marvel Sunbow comic. It's really great.
I think I've never seen it until this moment.
Wow, you missed out.
You stumped a retro.
You should play it. It's fun. Mm-hmm. It's again.
It looks cool. It's
just doing this.
I would love to see Konami put out a collection of all their licensed arcade games from back in the day. You know, they were doing stuff like The Simpsons and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. So this was just another one that they picked up and were like, let's make a game out of an American license. And it was great.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Yeah, it looked cool.
All right. Well, anyway, so that's the history of G.I. Joe and video games. We're not going to talk about the stuff based on the live action movie because no. But anyway, yeah, I could obviously talk about this a whole lot more, but I'm not going to. Maybe I'll start a G.I. Joe podcast. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, I do hope
podcast
everyone...
Podcast The Pit.
Real American Podcast.
Nice. I do hope everyone will check out the NES game and see if I'm right or if these guys are right, I'm right. And come to your own conclusions. If you ever happen to see the arcade game in person, play it, because it's a four-person game, right? I'm trying to remember. It's definitely two players, I think up to four.
I think you're right. I saw some options for four players.
Yeah. You know?
This sounds like the greatest game I've never played.
It's fantastically bad. I mean, like, bad in a wonderful way.
It's like there is no thought to it, but it's so fun to just see, like, oh, that's the Silent Castle.
Yeah, you know? I mean, they seriously put like 10 minutes of thought into the game design.
Wow.
And just said, you know, we're going to make up for the lack of subtlety with just sheer joy. Everything is going to be so fun because you're blowing everything up.
Yeah. Also, it is great to literally just run at a base as Snake Eyes laying waste to everything in your path.
Super I do fun. Take issue with the fact that when you put a quarter in Snake Eyes, if you're playing a Snake Eyes, he says Yojo. Not acceptable.
Should just say dot, dot, dot.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But I'm willing to forgive it that one licensing error. It happens. Anyway, guys, tell us about yourselves, where we can find you on the internet. Benj.
I'm Benj Edwards. You can find me on Twitter at Benj Edwards and also vintagecomputing.com.
I'm Chris Sims. You can find everything that I do at the-isb.com. I'm also on Twitter as the ISB, where my icon for the past 10 years has been a screenshot of Destro laughing on the cartoon, where he is mysteriously hot pink for some reason.
And finally, I'm Jeremy Parrish, the co-host of Retronauts. Retronauts is at retronauts.com on podcast services like iTunes and at the Podcast One Network. We are supported through Patreon, patreon.com/retronauts. That's what pays for me to be able to eat and to be able to have a home where these people can come and talk about video games and G.I. Joe with me. So if you'd like to help make that happen, check out patreon.com/retronauts. And you get cool stuff in exchange for your generosity. Anyway, that wraps it up for this episode. We'll have another episode soon because there's no escaping the Retronauts. Yo, Joe.